Hey, David, thanks so much for your time today, mate. Really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. I look forward to the interview.
Beautiful. So you've written a number of books about the economics of sport, with the latest one being The Rise of the National Basketball Association. And I thought, you know, let's have a conversation about this, talk about what made the NBA the way it is, the economics of the league, and obviously I'll try and build some bridges about how that actually can help the National Basketball League here in Australia, because obviously it's going through the hard times that is interesting, because in the first part of the book, which I'll get you to explain and give some context to in a moment, you talk about the NBA back in the 40s and 50s, where teams were folding mid-season, and you know, there was a whole bunch of other issues happening with the financial element and the stability of the league, and trying to get fans to go to the games and things like that, and playing out of non-purpose-built stadiums, which is happening here in Australia. Like the Melbourne Tigers team here is playing a number of their games at the National Netball Centre, which, you know, works fine for the basketball and things like that. But it was just interesting reading that introduction about what was happening to the NBA in the, you know, 40s and early 50s. It seems like that is what the NBL is experiencing here in Australia, which is really interesting. So that's why I really like loved and got really into your book. So for those who aren't aware of the rise of the National Basketball Association as a book, can you explain the purpose of the book, what it's about, and why you wrote it?
Yes, I'm a longtime sports fan. My older brother was a basketball player on our high school team, and so I grew up watching the NBA during the 1960s, and it was always some permutation of Boston versus Philadelphia 76ers, the Los Angeles Lakers. The other six teams didn't seem to exist anymore.
Yeah.
But you got to see such great players, Bill Russell, Will Chamberlain, Elgin Baylor, Jerry West, that whole pantheon of legends, so to speak. I'm an economist by training, and sports economics is a growing field. There's a lot of way to apply economic theory to sports because we have lots of data. In fact, as you probably know, there are tons of people researching data and crunching the numbers and coming up with their own little formulas. So because there's a lot of playing productivity data on their playing ability, that's one attraction. The other attraction is that in the 50s, there were a series of congressional hearings, and the teams were forced to divulge their financial record to an extent that they would never divulge them again.
Mm.
So it's a very unique window into the operation of the league. By the 1950s, the National Basketball is now is established, and they have about 8 franchises, although many of these franchises will eventually relocate. My guess is if we were to make a comparison between the National Basketball League and the league in Australia, part of the problem might be is you have a handful of relatively large cities, and then you have a number of maybe mid-sized or even smaller cities, and it's somewhat difficult to create a league out of cities of such different sizes, unless, of course, you have Sydney have multiple teams, which would be one road to go down.
Mm.
But in some sense, that's similar to what happened, because the National Basketball Association is basically a combination of the National Basketball League and the Basketball Association of America. The NBA doesn't particularly like to acknowledge that its predecessor had to kind of merge with the National Basketball League. The National Basketball League in the 1940s had probably the best players, but they were mostly in very small towns. In fact, the town across the river from where I teach, Waterloo, Iowa, which was probably about 70,000 people, they had a team in this league, and they were in the National Basketball League for 1 year. The idea, of course, that a city with 70,000 could support a National Basketball Association franchise is risible.
Yeah.
But I suspect that may be a problem with Austin. For the Australians, is that you do have a pretty disparate population centers. I believe Sydney, your largest city?
Yeah, it is. And Sydney, for quite a while, has sort of had two teams, then one of them will fold for a couple of years, then there'll be a resurgence again, and then it'll fold again. And it's been interesting, because Melbourne, historically, like back in the 90s when you know, basketball was at its peak here in Australia, Melbourne, as our second largest city, had about 4, maybe 5 teams from memory at one point, and over time they all sort of continually merged together, and now we've just got one team here in Melbourne, and recently there was a bid here by a group of local business people trying to get a second license for a second team, and the league actually knocked it back and said, we're just not ready for another team in Melbourne. We don't think that it's sustainable with the way the sport is in the country. So I do applaud the league and the commission for sort of saying, okay, hang on, we're aware of where we're at, and we need to sort of put some more foundational stuff in place before we have another team that comes and goes very quickly. But it is such a shame that, you know, basketball is like something like the second or third largest participated sport by, you know, children in the country, yet it can't sustain a successful league. So, you know, what was it about the sort of the 50s and the 60s that really gave that the league the turn? Obviously, there was the merging of the what was the Basketball Association of America and the National Basketball League. Do you think that merge was a big pivotal change that really helped?
Almost definitely. It's not obvious that the leagues would have survived. My guess is probably what would have happened is eventually whoever survived in the next couple of years, they might have just merged anyway, but it certainly sped things along. And of course, after they merged for that one season with 17 teams, by the next season they were down to 11, and for the next two or three seasons they'd lose one more team until they got down to 8.
Yeah.
And then, as I said, of those 8 teams, the five were actually survivors from the National Basketball League, so more of their teams survived than did the Basketball Association, even though they were in the bigger cities with bigger stadiums. Mm-hmm. Eventually, the five National Basketball League teams would transfer to bigger cities, and of course the Minneapolis Lakers becoming the Los Angeles Lakers is the most famous example. But Showtime originated in Minneapolis.
That was when who was playing back there?
That was Jordan Mikan.
George Mikan, that was it. Yeah. One thing you mentioned, which is a continual debate, I think, around sports in general, is you made the comment before that the National Basketball League had the best players. And then obviously, you know, you're going in the book, and as you mentioned just then, that it was the National Basketball League, you know, in America that then had that sustainability from the teams. Realistically, as an economist, how much do you actually think the success and the sustainability of those National Basketball League clubs as they merged into the NBA was based on having better players compared to better business structures and better marketing? What's your take on that as an economist?
I'm not sure they had better management or promotion. They were very provincial. In fact, in many ways, I would liken the National Basketball League owner to American baseball minor league owners. And they were small-town business people. Some of them, of course, were fairly wealthy, but they weren't plutocrats by any means. They weren't the gentlemen that are buying Manchester Union or something, where you basically have to have billions of dollars that you can afford to invest in the team. Oftentimes, these people might have had a manufacturing company or a car dealership or a bank, or maybe they own the local arena. But they were pretty small-scale entrepreneurs in the National Basketball League. They had kept the league going from 1937, so they must have been doing something right, but they were geographically close. I suppose maybe in Australia that might be another factor, that it might be relatively expensive to have to go to Perth or some of your other cities, because it's a large country.
Yeah, absolutely. So every team when they play, they're on an airplane. There is no real bus or, you know, day trip type games, you know, and to the point where we've actually got a team from New Zealand in our national league. So, you know, teams from Perth have to actually fly all the way across Australia and then obviously through to New Zealand to actually play a game. So every team, every game is a substantial journey, so to speak.
Oh, which are they based out of Auckland?
I think they are. Yeah, the team's called the New Zealand Breakers, so they're kind of a national team in our league. But yeah, I'm pretty sure it's Auckland where they're based.
Oh, okay. Because I'm looking at a population list of Australia, and you've got roughly 5 cities with a million or more in the, I guess, the statistical district, or what do they call it? So it's the city and the suburbs.
Yeah.
And then it drops off to Gold Coast, Newcastle, and Canberra, about a half million. And now you're beginning, I think, to get into where it's going to be difficult to maintain a team, just simply because you've got some fixed costs, you've got your stadium costs, you've got your player roster, which no matter how poor a team you're going to field, I'm assuming there's some base amount of money you have to pay these players.
Of course.
So if you simply can't get enough at the gate, then you're not going to be able to cover your costs no matter what happens. And so you got five cities with more than a million, and I believe Auckland is two.
Yeah.
So you've got about six cities, and the rest of them would be, they'd have to be awfully dedicated fans. And that's quite possible. There are some small towns that will, the fans will come out in droves, but you have to work pretty hard to get them to come out, and I think you have to have a pretty decent team. Green Bay, of course, in American football is probably the paramount example, but that's a special case. They were located fairly close to Milwaukee.
Yeah.
And they were heavily subsidized by the league.
And this is the interesting thing, is that the funny thing is, if you look at most of the teams with the actual best, I'd say, quote-unquote, gate revenue. Now, again, there hasn't been an inquiry or anything like the NBA had in the 1950s where owners have to release all their financial data. But sort of looking at it and speaking to people, it's teams like Perth and Cairns and Townsville. So, you know, Cairns and Townsville are very sort of, I'd call them rural cities here in Australia. They're not the capitals or anything like that. And they actually are doing relatively well in terms of bums on seats and people going to the games. And I think primarily the reason for that is there's less distraction. They don't have a national sporting team in other codes, so to speak. So that is sort of the one thing the town has as a pride type thing. It's for the community to get behind, and that's been very successful. But when you look at, you know, places like Brisbane and Melbourne and Sydney, it's been harder for those cities to actually sustain a team, which is very, very odd when you sort of look at from the outside as an economist. You think, well, hang on, the cities with the biggest population and the biggest sort of, you know, financial economy should be able to support a team more financially, but it hasn't necessarily been the case here in Australia. And it's very strange, because if you look back, you know, into the early and mid-90s, when basketball in Australia was at its peak, it had teams in Newcastle and the Gold Coast and Illawarra and some of these sort of, you know, second-tier sort of areas, and they were, you know, relatively sustainable, which is very, very interesting to sort of see what's changed and what's, you know, happened over the last few years here in Australia.
Well, it might be simply because in Sydney you've got such a plethora of alternative entertainment venues. That's very similar to New York, of course. You can go see the New York Knicks in the 40s and 50s with and their team was okay, but they didn't have a marquee player. You could go see them, or you could go to the opera, you could go to Broadway, you could go to the movie, you could, if there was overlapping season, see the New York Giants football, and maybe on the other end of the season, New York Giants baseball team. There are just so many alternatives for people in New York, whereas I'm assuming, as you said, in Canberra and in Cairn, they're probably not the alternative, maybe some movie houses and stuff. But
that's exactly right. And this is something that I've been extremely vocal on, and people who have sort of listened to the show before or read some of the things I've written about this, is that's been my biggest stance and my biggest vocal point, is that the league, and they're getting better at it, but the league has to understand that their competition is not Australian rules football or other sort of sporting codes necessarily. Their competition now expands to the internet and the movie theaters and the Nintendo Wiis and the Sony PlayStations and things like that. It's the entertainment dollar that is your competition, and that is something that I think is very interesting. And one of the really cool things that I actually read in your book was the story about I think it was the St. Louis Hawks, who the owner did something quite unique to try and get ladies to come to the games. Is he was giving away a jar of coffee with every ticket?
Or something.
Yeah.
And
it actually worked out to be more cost effective for the ladies to go to a game of basketball and get their coffee than to buy it at the supermarket or something like that, which I thought was a very creative way of selling tickets.
Well, you may recall, I believe he also said that the ladies, he surmised, and again, this is sort of a sexist 1950s view, but he surmised that basketball was inherently more popular than football, let's say, because the guys are out there in shorts.
Yep.
Rather than being in some sort of body armor. And so he made that remark that maybe the women like to come out because you could see these athletic men in shorts and tights, so to speak. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's an interesting idea.
Well, you know, I think, you know, Australia actually has some good data to support that argument, because probably it might have been about 10 years ago. So funnily enough, you know, and this is a gut correlation, there's no sort of you know, stats behind this that I have off the top of my head, but about the same time that the Australian Basketball League started to dip in attendance and dip in popularity, the Australian Football League, which is always, it's fundamentally a religion here in Australia, Australian rules football, it's the powerhouse of sport, but they actually ran a nationwide advertising campaign that is still spoken about today. And the campaign, campaign's tagline was, "I'd like to see that." So they had, you know, like Michael Jordan come on the commercial and say, "Guys jumping, you know, 15 feet in the air, I'd like to see that." And then they had, you know, some religious person come on and say, you know, "A religion that doesn't have a patron saint, I'd like to see that." And then one of the very last things was a female of some description. I can't remember, some famous female coming on and saying, you know, 30 sweaty, hot, muscular men running around in short shorts, I'd really like to see that. And that was the tagline of the advert. And it was huge. Like, that was like probably one of the best sporting marketing campaigns I've ever seen across the world. Like, it was just hugely successful here in Australia. And, you know, off the back of that, the attendance rose and the female demographic going to the games has just risen immensely. And primarily off that same argument that the St. Louis Hawks owner said, is that it's because of the short shorts. And, you know, the sex appeal went to the football and away from what was basketball here in Australia, because, you know, it's a little, you know, sexist or racist, and, you know, they used to play up, you know, we have the American imports coming over and they'd play up the sex appeal of the, you know, the big muscly American players and things like that. And then the Australian Football League really stole that off the back of that same principle from that was used in the NBA in the 1950s, which is very interesting.
Well, that's interesting. Now, I'm not real familiar with Australian football. It's reputed to be one of the toughest games in the sporting world, right?
Absolutely. It's hit as hard as gridiron, but without any pads.
Okay, and are the players typically real big, or are they rather light so they can run around quicker?
Yeah, they're not big like American linebackers or anything like that. They're muscular, but they're very agile. So it's more about being quick and strong as opposed to being big as like, you're not trying to be a big brick wall like a lineman for a football team.
Oh, okay. So, and they have teams, what do they have, 16 teams or?
Yeah, they've got, for example, Melbourne is sustaining right now probably five or six teams. I'm a football fan, but I can't think off the top of my head how many teams we have, but Sydney's got two, the Gold Coast has got a team, Brisbane's, there's a team, Perth, there's three or four, five or six in Melbourne. So, you know, our bigger cities can sustain these, and the NBA, and, you know, the AFL is getting, you know, 50,000-60,000 people to an average game. So it's like, it's not a small sport in any imagination in terms of attendance and money and things like that. But basketball just seems to have completely died off from being what was the second most, attended sport and watched sport to being so far down the track.
I mean, if we were talking before we went on the air, I suppose maybe perhaps that's somewhat of a function of the fact that they don't have an NBA superstar of their own to root for. At least with Luke Longley, he was on a very prominent team.
Yep.
You mentioned the gentleman now currently playing for the Spurs. Maybe that will help rekindle things, because the Spurs are year in, year out, one of the better teams in the league.
Mm.
They're a fairly high-profile team, so maybe that'll boost things.
And I think it has, like, you know, Patty Mills came back during the lockout, the recent lockout that the NBA had, and played some games with the Melbourne Tigers, a team here in Australia, and definitely got a bit more exposure in the media, and definitely got some more people going to the games and things like that. But obviously, once the lockout was over, you know, he actually went and played some interim games in China on the way back to the US before he signed with the Spurs and obviously moved from Portland. And that did spark up a little bit of, attention and stuff while he was here in the country. But as soon as he sort of went back to the US, it kind of dipped again. Now, you know, I'm talking like it's all doom and gloom. But definitely the attendance is rising and it is heading in the right direction. But it's just been a slow growth and a slow change for the league. It's been very strange.
Oh, well, I suppose it might be somewhat cyclical, but perhaps it'll bounce back.
Yeah, look, pardon the pun, I hope it does bounce back, really. You know, it's a great sport. And this is the interesting thing, is that, you know, from an actual quality of the game, like, you know, I think this is part of it too. And, you know, the NBA, you know, with things like the 24-second shot clock, and this is what I'd love to talk about and get your take on from your research, is that one of the things that the Australian Basketball League did a few years ago is actually changed fundamentally all the rules to match FIBA, like, obviously, the international standard. So, you know, 4 10-minute quarters and, you know, the three-point line and the shot clock and all that sort of stuff was made to match FIBA. Now, my argument and my take on this is that is great if you want to win, like, you know, Olympic medals and stuff like that. But Olympic medals, unfortunately, don't pay the bills on a weekly basis and get people to come to the games. And, you know, how much influence, you know, from your perspective, do you think things like the 24-second shot clock and some of the rule changes that were happening at that time in the NBA actually paved the way for a more entertaining experience for the fans?
Well, certainly this 24 clock, as most everybody recognizes, was a pivotal moment in the league development. Surprisingly, it didn't immediately ignite larger crowds. It took a while for people to start responding to that. But prior to that, you have to remember that if you went to an NBA ball game, let's say 1951, it would be a very different experience than what you have even by, let's say, 67, just a generation of players or two generations of players removed. The game was very rough. Some of the people, there was probably a lot of set shots. In fact, we were talking about that yesterday, one of my colleagues and I, and of course, nowadays, you don't see anybody shoot a set shot.
No.
But the jump shot was slowly percolating throughout not only the pros, but the college and the high school players. Probably not even until the 1960s did it really become overwhelmingly the dominant. But it would have been a different game because apparently some of these set shooters were pretty accurate from, they claim, 30, 35 feet out, which I guess, having seen a few old-timers shoot the set shot, I guess you can. Of course, it presupposes there's not somebody in your face with their hand up. It was a very, by our view, it might have seemed a more primitive style of basketball, although clearly these were good players, and they knew their style of game inside out. I'm sure you'd see a lot of teamwork, a lot of moving, cutting, and maybe in that sense it would more resemble, let's say, European soccer or football,
yep,
in the sense that there's a lot of movement and there's a lot of patterns how they run their plays. I don't think there would have been as much of the one-on-one thing that many of today's fans cherish in the NBA. Now, obviously, there's other fans who wish it was more a team game, but you have elements of both.
Mm.
But the NBA, and they played in pretty primitive arenas. Sometimes they even played in high school,
yep,
basketball gyms, which just don't have the amenities of even a very poor professional arena. It's a very fly-by-night league. They didn't have any posses or entourages of people to carry their luggage. The classic story that they all tell was that they'd take the train ride, which, of course, is different because they were riding a train. You can imagine being a 6'7" person having to sleep in a sleeper berth,
yep,
like you see in the movies where they fold down from the sides. I don't think there's any way a 6'7" person can diagonally even get themselves into the bed.
Nah.
And they stop at the middle of the night. They have to carry their luggage about a half mile to a roadside or a crossroad settlement of a store and maybe a little diner. And then they would arrange for four cars to come and pick them up and drive them into Fort Wayne, Indiana, which was one of the mainstays of the league.
Mm.
A completely different experience than what you have today.
Yeah.
It was just pretty much they were scrimping pennies. Some of the owners were so penurious that they would not even supply soap in the other team's locker room.
Wow.
They would drive cars. They wouldn't take a bus even to get to the games. It was just, they must have really loved the game.
Yeah, you have to be very, very passionate about that. So things like the 24-second shot clock and other rule changes obviously over time made that transition for the game to be more entertaining. And obviously it was the entertainment dollar that really got the patrons to come along. Is that a fair correlation?
Well, it's partly the 24-second clock, and then partly because I think you get better athletes coming into the league.
Yeah.
Now, there's a difference between a good basketball player and a good athlete in the sense that there are some people who are pretty good athletes, but they're not basketball players, and then there are some basketball players who are not very athletic. Now, obviously, by the time you get to the NBA, you pretty much have a merger of the two skill sets because you can't be a good athlete probably and stay in the NBA. But you start with the integration that started in the early 50s. Now you're getting the Bill Russells, the Wilt Chamberlains, the Elgin Baylors. I can only imagine what it must have been like to sit in that audience and you see Elgin Baylor for the first time. I don't know if you know much about Elgin Baylor, but he's basically sort of the Luke Skywalker of that time. He's able to elevate his game. He's able to dunk. He just explosive and just a fan favorite. And then, of course, you have Wilt Chamberlain, who just in my mind, he's one of the great athletes of all time, just simply because you think about what he could do. He was big, he's strong, he could run track for Kansas.
Yeah.
I mean, people forget that he ran track for Kansas.
Wow, I never knew that. Wow.
Yeah, I didn't think he did the high hurdles, and he was quite confident. And then later, of course, after he retired from the NBA, he played professional volleyball. And I think I joke in the footnotes of the book that, would you want to be on the receiving end of one of his spikes?
Yeah.
Imagine a 7'1" or whatever he really was, and his long arms and the torque he could get on that. I'm sure he could have just spiked that ball to a lethal speed.
That would have been incredible to watch in its own right.
Yeah, and then of course you get the incomparable Oscar Robertson.
Yeah,
he just was a perfect ball player. Maybe he didn't choose to be as flashy as some of the later players, but my guess is that you'd be hard pressed to find anybody who was actually a better basketball player than Oscar Robertson. Michael Jordan might be his equal, but I would be hard pressed to say he was better. These are players who just revolutionized the game, and these are the players you think about when you think of the NBA. Unfortunately for Mr. Mikan, you don't think of George Mikan when you think of the NBA.
No, because he was that generation or so too early. And obviously, you know, if you're passionate, you know the name, and you know a bit about his legacy. But he's definitely not, one of the top 10 when you sort of ask the general public about, you know, that they might drop Wilt, they'll drop, Elgin, Michael, you know, Kobe now, obviously, with his recent, 300,000 point club, or whatever the number was. So in terms of television, let me ask you this one final question. I don't want to take up too much of your time, Dave, because I know you're busy.
It's fun. It's always fun to talk to people that are interested in the book.
Yeah, so what about the television side of things? How did that, the impact of that have on the league and things?
Well, the NBA took a very different attitude toward television than the National Football League would later take. The NBA was at first quite suspicious, and they were also very shocked that anybody would be willing to pay money to put an NBA game on TV. Mm. In fact, there's the little anecdote where I believe it's the New York Knicks guy, and somebody comes up and says, well, you know, we'd like to put some games on the local, I believe it was an ABC affiliate. And the guy said, well, how much will it cost me? They won't cost you anything. We will pay you to show the games. And I think they got something on the order of $500 or something. But back then, for 7 games, $500, $3,500 would pay most of the salaries of one of your players. So it wasn't trivial. But it certainly was a far cry from what they had today. They actually admitted, or one of the owners admitted, because they thought televising the games would just take away from the home attendance, they actually had a policy of putting the word teams on, and they may exaggerate to some degree, but he said we didn't want to show the best games because we thought that was giving away the goods, so we showed some of the worst teams. And you go back and you look at the record, and to some degree that was true. Some of the worst teams seemed to be on a little bit more, but all the teams eventually did get on. And what's interesting is that they eventually got around to sharing the money equally from the national contract years before the NFL ever did it. Mm. Now, they didn't do it because they were so altruistic. The amount of money to be shared was a pittance, but they just did it because I guess nobody figured they were losing anything by doing it.
Yeah, so in terms of in America, in terms of the television of sporting codes and games, what was the NBA one of the very first to have that transition to television or not?
Well, baseball obviously preceded them
with
television. I believe the NBA started getting national attention on television. I think it's more in the mid-50s.
Yeah.
And fortunately for them, it was on maybe not fortunately, but it started out on a network, if I recall correctly, that eventually became defunct because it was a fourth network, or at the time it was a third network. But what's probably more important is that the games that would have been televised before the 24-second clock probably weren't very conducive to pleasant television watching. In fact, they don't claim that the famous 19-18 game between the Lakers and Fort Wayne, they claim that was what triggered the 24-second clock, but that's 3 or 4 years before. What other people claim was a game between the Knicks and the Celtics. It may have been a playoff game, and it took a long time to play because there were overtime, there were fouls here, fouls there. I believe they said there were 90 fouls or something ridiculous, and it was ugly, and the network didn't even finish the game. They pulled the plug and went on. So it was probably just as well that, A, they weren't drawing a lot of fans then to see that and be turned off, and then, B, when they begin to get the televised interest, they've got the 24-second clock and the game has been transformed.
Yeah.
And in that sense, the timing may have been a little more fortuitous for them.
Mm. But Sorry to cut you. I was going to say, just as a side point for listeners, I've just finished a really interesting book, The Story of ESPN. I think it's called These Guys Have All the Fun. And it's been a really interesting read, just around about how the economics of sport on television work, because obviously ESPN being the first 24/7 sports television station in the world, it was just interesting to see the growth and the story of that. So it's a complete side note, but it was a really interesting book about the economics of the television of sport and how that business grew and how they funded it and the trials and tribulations they went through to actually make that actually happen, become the global behemoth that ESPN is now, which is really cool.
Yeah, well, they used to have tractor pulls because they were sort of the butt of everybody's jokes in the early 80s when they first debuted. People thought 24-hour sports.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, who would do that? And now, like, they've got, you know, about 7 different channels, and it's just in America alone and things. So, you know, besides the book on the NBA, you've written a number of books on sport and economics of sport, you know, particularly around baseball and things like that. What are some of the big key takeaways that you know, the NBA could potentially take from baseball, or that make baseball, you know, very successful? Like, you know, obviously you've got the winners, losers, and empty seats, how baseball outlasted the Great Depression. What's some of the things around that other leagues could look at and potentially take or already have? Anything around that? I know it's a bit of a left-field question for you, Dave.
No. It's I guess facetiously, it probably wouldn't have been best if the NBA had preceded Major League Baseball. Major League Baseball was able to get that antitrust exemption in the States, and the other leagues did not. And by the time National Basketball Association debuts, baseball is the national pastime, and there's all the sort of aura around baseball. And I love baseball, but I think a lot of the aura is kind of silly.
Yeah.
But that's going to prove to be a big advantage for baseball. They can do things that the National Football League and the National Basketball League and the National Hockey League cannot do. And
so that's like, I know a little bit about that. You know, books like Hardball and some other sort of stuff kind of touch on it a little bit,
sure,
which I really enjoy. But for people who don't understand the whole antitrust sort of differences, can you touch on that really quickly to give some context?
Well, I guess you've sort of alluded to it. I'm assuming that in your Australian football, that it's pretty easy if you want to field a team to get into the league and to be in a city that already has teams in it. Is that correct?
Yeah, you have to obviously get approval from the league and things like that. But yeah, just, you know, in the last couple of years, there was a second city team that joined, you know, just this last sort of period of time. And then just before that, a couple of years earlier, there was a new Gold Coast team. So the league is pushing that for growth because it can sustain it because, as I said before, football is basically, you know, a religion. It is our version of baseball, if not more so. From that perspective, so it is relatively easy for someone like a club to join with the league support, obviously.
Sure. Whereas in baseball, it's very difficult to put another team in a city that already has a team. If you tried to put another team in New York City, there'd be lawsuits galore, and quite possibly the Yankees and Mets would be held would prevail simply because they have this antitrust exemption. Normally, in American economics, if somebody wants to move into your territory, you can't stop them that way. You can stop them by promoting a better product, but you can't stop them by saying, no, we're the league, you can't join the league, and you can't come into the city. Even if you're a new league, we're going to try to fight you. And they can try to fight you in ways that typically a lot of American businesses might not be able to get away with. The National Basketball Association, the National Football Association, I'm sure those owners wish that they had the same kind of blanket antitrust, but they've done okay for themselves without it.
Mm. Well, this is a question that's always confused me. Why does LA not have a National Football League team?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it? They did originally have two.
Yeah, they had the Raiders at one
46.
Point, didn't they? Yeah.
They had the Rams, and then they had a team in the All-American Football Conference. And that proved to be, well, they would argue it was unsustainable. I believe the attendance figures were pretty comparable for the two teams. Eventually, my understanding is the Rams moved to Anaheim because they could get a better stadium deal, and I believe there were probably some sort of luxury boxes involved because that's what the national football owners lust after, are the luxury boxes.
Yeah.
I guess I'm being too alliterative there with less luxury. But anyway, So they left for Anaheim. Now, you could argue that Anaheim really sort of L.A., although I suppose Southern California listeners might not agree with that. Then you may recall that Al Davis tried to move the Raiders down to Los Angeles for a while because it was a lucrative place and you had the Coliseum.
Yep.
After a while, he went back to Oakland, and the city's been sort of open ever since. I don't know. That is an interesting question. And people do wonder, when will the league put another team in there? You can imagine that if it was an expansion team, they could probably charge more for that than they've ever charged for any other expansion team because you'd go in L.A.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
They may be saving it because if they have a struggling franchise, maybe they want to switch it in there. But I don't know. I guess you'd have to be a fly on the wall listening to the owners at the meeting to see what exactly is going on.
No, very cool. Well, let me ask you this one final question, Dave. This is a question I ask everyone I speak to. What's the one question I haven't asked you that I probably should have about the book, about the topic, about the stuff we've spoken about today?
Oh, my, that's an interesting question.
It always throws people. I love it.
Well, I guess it would be I suppose we could have covered how much the player made back in the 1940s and 50s because people are so interested in player salaries.
Yeah, they're great. There you go. That's a perfect question.
And so the NBA is a classic case of a league that doesn't make enough money to pay really top flight salaries, but on the other hand, they can't cut the salaries too much because they're always boasting that they were boasting back in the 50s that most of their players were college graduates.
Mm-hmm.
And so a college graduate, even back in the 1950s, could make more than the average American.
Yeah.
So if you cut the pay too much, they would just stay in industry. And in fact, there were a few very talented players that the pros coveted that ended up choosing to stay in business because some of these businesses would have a company basketball team. They were semi-pro. And then you could start your career as an executive. So then when you quit playing basketball, you were already an executive.
Huh.
So the NBA had combat that for quite a while. In addition, of course, for many of the top flight African-American players, they had to combat the Harlem Globetrotters, who at that time played serious basketball. They were not the Globetrotters that we know today who are there to entertain you with their antics. These were top-notch basketball players who, I believe, one year beat the Lakers in the World Championships in 1946 or 47. So they were a very competitive team. But most of these people were not getting rich, even George Mikan at $15,000 to $20,000 a year. Today, in today's purchasing power in America, I don't even believe that would be any of the professional league minimum salary. And he dominated the league. He won championships in almost every year he played except for the year he got hurt and maybe one other year. He was a dominant player.
Yeah.
But he just was at the wrong time. And it probably doesn't help that when he wore those glasses, he looked like the guy that played Clark Kent in the TV version of Superman, mild-mannered Clark Kent.
Yeah,
and he was not a mild-mannered player. He was a tough player.
Yeah.
But he just didn't project the same way, and he wore a bow tie.
I don't know about you.
Yeah, I don't know about Australian, but from my point of view, a bow tie, it just screamed dweeb. I'm sorry, but
it
screamed dweeb. And he's not a dweeb, but that was the fashion back then.
Yeah.
So I think on that metric, he just came in at the wrong time.
Yeah, and you talk about in the book a little bit as well about how you touched on that, you know, there was some sponsorship stuff happening and starting to kind of trickle through at that point, and there was companies that would use him in their adverts but have him in his blazer, bow tie, and glasses as opposed to a basketball uniform, which was very interesting.
Yes, it is, and he's wearing his glasses, and he's retired.
It was after he actually stopped playing, they actually started using it as a spokesperson, which was very interesting.
Yes, I guess the Minneapolis team had the clever idea that they wanted to put him on a children's show in Minneapolis to help publicize the team. I don't believe they ever did that, but that would have been kind of an interesting situation to see George Mikan or some sort of children's favorite.
Sitting there reading the books and then telling the time and stuff like that would have been very, very interesting to see.
Yep.
Well, David, really appreciate your time today, mate. Thank you so much for taking some time out of your schedule and between classes and to talk about your book, The Rise of the National Basketball Association.
Well, you're certainly welcome. It's been a lot of fun to be on your show. And feel free, when the National Football League comes out next year, feel free to get in touch.
Oh, beautiful. So there's a book about the NFL. Fantastic.
Yep.
So
yep.
Same sort of thing?
Next November.
Beautiful. So the same sort of thing, the rise of the Football League and how the whole league got together and the TV deals that they do and all that sort of stuff. Is that the idea?
Yep, yep.
Fantastic. Beautiful, mate. Well, thank you so much and appreciate your time.
Great. Take care.